From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. On this week's podcast, how some people are preparing for the big one.
This is an earthquake drill. Drop, cover, and hold on.
A drug shortage forces states to improvise.
States had to come up with new protocols to conduct lethal injections, and basically what that's meant is finding new drugs.
A first-time film composer gets a wide-open canvas, the sea.
It was nothing specific. The only real specific thing I got was no piano.
And just in time for Halloween, why Frankenstein still fascinates. Turns out a lot of us relate to the monster.
I was that creature that wanted to fit in to society, but was consistently told that I couldn't.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's morning recess at the St. Augustine Catholic School. Another sunny day here in Culver City, California. Kids running around in navy blue uniforms complete the idyllic scene. But away from the basketball hoops and the games of tag, the staff is preparing. Custodian Billy Figueroa opens the metal doors to a large cargo container next to the playground. He points out some of the supplies.
Okay, we have water.
Enough water to last 300 people about 5 days.
We got duct tape, twine.
There's an axe and a shovel.
Also, we have our generator, gasoline for the generator.
All of these supplies are here just in case. Just in case the freeways are cut off or the power goes out. Just in case of a major destructive earthquake. Because in Southern California and communities from St. Louis to Seattle, millions of Americans live in areas at risk for earthquakes. But experts say we have not taken the simple steps to protect ourselves. That's our cover story today, preparing for the big one. At exactly 10:17 a.m., Principal Beata Wen comes over the loudspeaker.
This is an earthquake drill. Drop, cover, and hold on.
The kids tuck in their arms and legs and take cover under their desks. They're part of the Great Shakeout, an earthquake drill with almost 20 million participants around the country.
We are now leaving the building. Evacuate for the drill.
With the all-clear signal, the students, almost 300 of them, file out of their classrooms.
Fourth grade, we're not talking. No talking, fourth grade.
And they arrange themselves in circles on the playground.
Preschool, hand up if you're present.
On a beautiful day on a school playground, the danger can feel a little abstract. But Principal Wen says the drills are absolutely necessary.
Well, hopefully, we are in a position to at least minimize the impact.
Minimize the impact. That's the goal. Craig Fugate is the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And when an earthquake hits, FEMA will respond, but individuals need to be ready.
In large-scale, complex-type events such as an earthquake, everybody needs to understand you're just not going to be able to call 911 and somebody's going to show up immediately. So the more people are prepared, the better we're able to respond to those types of disasters.
And what's your sense then? Do you think that most individual Americans are prepared?
Unfortunately, not as much as they need to. We know that when you talk about preparedness, a lot of people identify certain steps they've taken. But as we saw with Sandy and we've seen with other events, the better prepared that people are to take care of themselves, the more we can focus on the heavy impact areas and the people without resources. Generally, an earthquake's going to occur. Your first indications will be the shaking and you feel it. You need to know what to do. And what most experts recommend, what we recommend is, don't try to evacuate out of the building. You can get injured as things are falling. The best thing to do is to drop, get low, get under something heavy duty like a table or something, and cover your head and wait for the shaking to stop. And then if the building's damaged, then evacuate and go outside.
Because in areas around the country with significant fault lines, it's not a question of if an earthquake might strike, but when. And it turns out that is a tough question to answer.
I don't see us being able to say there'll be an earthquake Thursday at 3 o'clock.
That's Dr. Lucy Jones. She's the Senior Science Advisor for Risk Reduction at the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS. And Jones says scientists are close to proving one thing, that we might as well give up on predicting earthquakes.
The reason is you don't want me to predict every earthquake. What you want me to do is predict the one out of 50,000 that's large enough to do damage. So you're wanting a prediction of the magnitude as well as the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the problem lies, because it, as much as we can tell right now, the big and the small earthquakes begin the same way. They all begin by slipping on a very small part of the fault, and a small earthquake runs into something that stops it right away. A big earthquake gets past the nearby stuff and propagates down the fault and happens over that big surface before it runs into something that stops it. And as far as we can tell, every earthquake has some chance of pushing on down the fault, but only a very small number of them do.
So the when part of it is hard, but with these probabilities, can we have any sense of where they'll tend to hit or how damaging they'll be when they hit?
We can tell you a lot about where. So the U.S. Geological Survey publishes what are called the National Seismic Hazard Maps, and they show you which of the more dangerous places and the less dangerous places. And, you know, Los Angeles and San Francisco are big red blobs because we have lots of faults. And they will tell you the pattern of earthquakes on the long run. The other thing we can do really well is tell you what will happen when the earthquake does occur.
Mm-hmm.
We have a pretty good handle on, you know, if the earthquake happened tomorrow, what are going to be the half a dozen really critical sort of issues.
One of the reasons we know that is from experience.
Good evening, everybody. It was 30 seconds that seemed like an eternity. To say that this part of the world has been badly shaken is more than a play on words.
Just after 4 in the morning on January 17, 1994, a magnitude 6.7 earthquake struck Northridge, a neighborhood in northern Los Angeles. This is how ABC News reported the scene.
The quake lasted at most 30 seconds, but that was enough to snap water mains and gas lines like straws, triggering fires that destroyed entire neighborhoods throughout the San Fernando Valley.
More than 50 people died in the earthquake and its aftermath. Thousands were injured. It was the most destructive earthquake in the U.S. in the past century. Lucy Jones says we learned a lot from that earthquake, but society has changed a lot since then.
I mean, that earthquake is almost 20 years ago now. Our biggest unknown is what will be the impacts from a disruption to telecommunications. For instance, we don't have any regulations about the seismic securing of cell phone towers, and we don't really know how many of the cell phone towers will still be up after the earthquake. Another big issue is that we used to, at the time of Northridge, we had substantial food stockpiles because that's the way grocery stores operated. Now we run on a just-in-time economy and everything's brought in the day that it's needed, and we no longer have the big warehouses that we had at that point. I find a certain level of concern at what new vulnerabilities have we built into the system with all of these efficiencies that have come from the development of the internet economy.
One issue that has come up again and again is construction. And today, buildings must be made to withstand severe shaking. But no building code is retroactive. So there are a lot of buildings in earthquake-prone cities that aren't up to modern code and might collapse. And here in Los Angeles, one of the biggest problems is buildings made of concrete.
Concrete buildings, for one, are very large and they have a lot of people in them.
This is Ron Lynn. He's a reporter for the LA Times, and he and his colleagues have been looking into the number of buildings at risk.
And what it is about these buildings is that they don't have enough steel reinforcement bars in them or steel rebar in them. I mean, if you think about a column of clay and you kind of push down on both sides, the clay wants to expand out. But if you wrap that clay in a column of pencils, that would keep the clay in it. And that's what the steel reinforcement does. It keeps the concrete column whole during the shaking.
The LA Times looked into major concrete structures around the city. They pulled records and talked to owners of dozens of properties.
Many of these concrete buildings that are out there haven't been looked at by seismic engineers and also haven't been retrofitted. And that's one of the things that a lot of structural engineers tell us, is that the collapse of just one of these buildings could kill more people than in any of the catastrophes California has seen since the 1906 earthquake.
I'm just wondering, why did it take a newspaper like the LA Times to look into this, and you couldn't just go and find like the facts and figures from the city or a state agency?
Well, there's been a lot of resistance to creating such a list. In the past, the city has had numerous attempts at trying to make a list, and whenever these proposals came up, property owners were really opposed to doing a list. And so the proposals to figure out where these buildings were have always died.
This is a problem in Southern California, where quakes are a big part of people's lives. But there's also significant risk up and down the West Coast, as well as the Midwest and other regions. Lucy Jones says it's true that earthquakes are less frequent outside major hotspots.
But because of that, the communities are much less prepared for them. So, you know, the magnitude 5.8 in Virginia in 2011, you know, was actually felt by more people than any American earthquake. A relatively small earthquake that would have caused very little problem in California causes substantial damage in these less prepared regions.
But Dr. Jones says it's important to put the risk in perspective. She says she's constantly getting messages from people who are scared.
My favorite one was a letter where someone said, "I know you can't tell me when the next earthquake's going to be, but will you tell me when your children go to visit out-of-town relatives?" And there's that belief that, you know, somehow the scientists know something. Because it's, in fact, the lack of knowledge, the unpredictability that makes earthquakes as frightening as they are. In fact, we tend to be more afraid of earthquakes than is really justified by the risks they pose to us compared to other risks. Flooding is just as dangerous as earthquakes, but you don't find people scared of the rain. We're scared of things we don't see. We're scared of things that we don't know when they're coming. And we're scared of things that we think science doesn't understand.
And here's a little bit of good news. The science is getting better. A project is underway in California to provide an early warning system for earthquakes. It might give people a few moments, maybe even a minute, to ready themselves. That might not sound like much, but it's enough time to get under a table, to turn off dangerous machinery, or for a surgeon to stop cutting. Because when an earthquake does strike, every second will count. And if you're still wondering if the scientists know something they're not telling, Dr. Jones is a fourth-generation Californian, and she says she has no plans to move. This is NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. One out of five Cambodians died under the brutal reign of the Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s. About 1.7 million people dead in a country less than half the size of California. There has been very little accountability for those crimes. Pol Pot, the leader of the Khmer Rouge, died at the age of 72 as he slept in his own bed. International prosecutors have not given up hope for some justice, at least. This past week, a joint UN and Cambodian prosecution team finished closing arguments in the war crimes trial against two of Pol Pot's lieutenants. Elizabeth Becker is a journalist and one of the few Westerners to see the country under the Khmer Rouge. She told me about who these two defendants are.
They're the last two leading figures of the Khmer Rouge movement. Nguyen Chia was number two, very much the lieutenant to Pol Pot, who ran the country. Khieu Samphan was essentially the head of state, a sort of an ideologue leader. There were two others who have been one who's been dismissed, Ying Thurit, the only woman, Minister of Social Affairs. She has dementia. And her husband, Ying Suri, the former foreign minister who died this March. So we're from the four defendants, we're down to two.
So I want to go over what they exactly were accused of doing during this time.
It's essentially leading a country that, from the first day of victory, enslaved the population with mass human rights violations, throwing people out of their houses with no medical facilities, many people dying on the way to the countryside where they were treated like slaves in labor camps, targeting minorities, getting rid of all the religions, getting rid of education. Essentially, it's mass human rights violations and genocide.
Can you put it into some context? How many others have faced justice?
There's only been one conviction so far, and that was a man who ran the Tuol Sleng Torture Center. His nickname is Doik, and he confessed before, in fact, the trial, and he was convicted and is now sending his life in prison. This trial started about 11 months ago.
You covered Cambodia as a reporter for The Washington Post. You were one of just a small handful of Westerners that was able to visit Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge reign. Did you ever interview these men?
Yes. I interviewed Pol Pot the day before the Vietnamese invasion that essentially overthrew him. And I interviewed Ying Suri as well and Ying Thurit. So a lot of my material, in fact, is being used as evidence in the trial.
When you interviewed these men, the key figures in the regime, what was your sense of their conscience, their sense of what they had done?
Well, it was definitely a learning experience. When I've interviewed them, this was at the end of the regime or after its collapse, and there was no question they were on their guard. To this day, they did not admit to guilt for what they did. And they had that revolutionary dogma that no matter what they did, it was for the good of the country. And they never changed.
With a delay in justice, and for so much of younger Cambodians, this history is almost an abstraction. What does this trial mean for Cambodia today?
It's meant a lot to the country because finally the world has acknowledged that they went through hell. And it's hard to exaggerate what it means when you know that your parents, your grandparents, the people in your village or in the city neighborhood, they've all talked about it to you, but the outside world never quite brought it to a trial. So this trial confirms that, yes, this was genocide. And it also shows that, in a sense, that there is such a thing as justice. Can you imagine Germany if there had never been any trials after the Holocaust? It would be unthinkable, and that's what's happening in Cambodia right now.
That's Elizabeth Becker. She's the author of When the War Was Over, Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge Revolution, and more recently, Overbooked. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've ever dreamed of living the writer's life, you're going to be jealous of Daniel Alarcón. Critics who reviewed his debut novel refer to authors such as Steinbeck and Marquez. He's won tons of prestigious literary awards, and he's still in his 30s. Alarcón's latest book takes place in an unnamed Latin American country scarred by war. It's called At Night We Walk in Circles and follows a young actor cast in a provocative play called The Idiot President. Daniel Alarcón, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks. Good to be here.
I'd like to start by asking you to read a passage from your book. Could you read the opening paragraph?
Okay. During the war, which Nelson's father called the anxious years, a few radical students at the conservatory founded a theater company. They read the French surrealists and improvised adaptations of Quechua myths. They smoked cheap tobacco and sang protest songs with vulgar lyrics. They laughed in public as if it were a political act, baring their teeth and frightening children. Their ranks were drawn, broadly speaking, from the following overlapping circles of youth: the long hairs, the working class, the sex crazed, the posers, the provincials, the alcoholics, the emotionally needy, the rabble-rousers, the opportunists, the punks, the hangers-on, the obsessed. Nelson was just a boy then, moody, thoughtful, growing up in a suburb of the capital with his head bent over a book. He was secretly in love with a slight, brown-haired girl from school with whom he'd exchanged actual words on only a handful of occasions. At night, Nelson imagined the dialogues they would have one day, he and this waifish, perfectly ordinary girl whom he loved. Sometimes he would act these out for his brother, Francisco. Neither had ever been to the theater.
So, without giving away any detailed plot points, could you describe the central character, Nelson? He's an actor and this theater troupe that he joins.
Nelson is kind of a bookish young man growing up in a war-torn country. He decides at a very young age he wants to be a playwright, wants to be a storyteller, and sort of pursues that dream. I shouldn't say he doesn't pursue it with much diligence, in the sense that his dream is in some ways based on this fantasy and this notion that he's going to one day leave for the United States because his older brother has already moved to the United States. And there's this idea that this visa is dangling before him and it's going to sort of save him from making any tough decisions about adulthood. And he sort of gets stuck in that space and eventually stumbles into this opportunity to join the theater troupe of his hero, a man named Henry Nunez.
What's The Idiot President about, the play that you had them do?
Well, The Idiot President is based on a play by a friend of mine named Walter Ventosilla. He gave me the script probably in 1999 or around then, and I adapted it and changed it. Basically, the president is joined by his idiot son and then a servant, and the premise of the play is that every citizen in the country is afforded the privilege of attending to the president each day. And they have to do his chores. They have to, tie his boots. They have to read his correspondence. They have to basically play to his ego, which is enormous. And at the end of each day, the servant is sacrificed, is killed.
As the book's building to that point, one of the things that's really, I'd have to say, fun about this book, and it's a literary book, so it seems weird to use the word fun, but
I think you can say fun. You can say fun. Literary books can be fun. I mean, there was a great quote from this writer Mickey Spillane who said something like, "No one ever read a novel to get to the middle. You want to get readers to get to the end, right? I mean, it's got to be fun.
And well, you do employ these devices that really drive you along, almost like a suspense novel. I mean, it's so hard to put this book down when you get to the last 50-odd pages.
Good. that's what I want.
Did you have that kind of concept in mind, that sort of structure in the way that things are this slowly revealed and become more intriguing and you just learning more and more as it goes along?
You know, it's funny, man. I mean, this book was like, there was nothing about the writing of this book that was fast paced or dynamic or, I mean, this was a terrible, terrible 7 years of creative stasis and dysfunction to get it to be that way. What did happen, however, was there was a couple of questions that kept nagging at me, and I felt a lot of urgency to answer them. The voice of the narrator, the fate of Nelson. And so if you're bugged by and made anxious to answer certain questions, then ideally that anxiety and that tension will create narrative tension.
You've already had a very successful, critically acclaimed novel. So what was up with the creative stasis and dysfunction?
Well, I mean, writing a novel is not at all like riding a bike. Writing a novel is like having to redesign a bike based on laws of physics that you don't understand in a new universe, And so having written one novel does nothing for you when you have to write the second one. Hmm. And in particular, this book, I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be a love story or love stories. I wanted it to be a little bit funnier than my first book, although I don't think that I necessarily succeeded on that.
Well, there's plenty of dark humor. There's a lot
there's
of
dark
it.
Humor. That's really the only kind of humor that I can pull off is the dark kind. There's some of that.
You know, the main character we've been talking about, Nelson, he's a young man. He's a young artist who's almost at that stage where he's dreaming the artist life as much as he's trying to live it. Mm-hmm. And as he goes through this experience of doing the play, he sees, it's safe to say, the more unromantic working side of that. I'm just wondering just how much you were drawing from your own experience, because you had to have been at that stage of dreaming, and now you've accomplished a fair amount with your writing.
Yeah, there's a line in the book that references Henry's friends, and it says, the painters, photographers, writers, poets, collectively known as artists in the same way that an astronaut is known as such without having ever gone to space. And it's true that there are people who live the idea of being an artist as opposed to the idea of making art. Henry's a snob. Nelson's a snob. To a certain extent, I'm a snob. but I say that with a great deal of reverence for art as a vocation and as a way of life. I mean, I'm genuinely impressed by that way of approaching the world. Sometimes I feel like it's the only sane way to live.
Daniel, a real pleasure talking with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Arun. It's been really, really fun.
Daniel Alarcón, his novel, At Night We Walk in Circles, hits shelves this week. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, always good to be with you, this time live from Mountain View.
So let's start out with some music this week. You have a profile of a young singer, I hadn't heard of her before this, Alexandra McDermott.
Unbelievable. This 18-year-old from Portland, Oregon. Arun, you got to do the audience a favor and play a little bit of her. She was discovered a couple of years ago on YouTube, just got signed literally this week to a big deal with Columbia Records, one of the major labels. And while she looks young and quiet, she's got one of those big, powerful voices that makes everyone kind of stop and stare.
Let's listen to that. This is her cover of Big Jet Plane. So she's taking off now, but she had a rough time in school?
She did. So she, sadly enough, she was bullied as a kid, and bullied badly enough, Arun, that she ultimately had to switch high schools. And then at a friend's suggestion in 2011, got on stage, performed at a school talent fair, and everybody went silent after she sang Adele's Someone Like You. And then less than 30 seconds later, burst out into applause, tears. So I'm looking forward to her first album dropping.
You also have a piece about a blog that another one I'd never heard of this before. It's starting to get a big following called Wait But Why.
You know, Arun, you and I and a ton of other people we know love infographics. The idea that the best way to explain something sometimes is clever graphics. This blog was started by two tutors. These guys were academic tutors, Tim Urban and Andrew Finn, and decided to get together and try and explain some of life's more important and sometimes more offbeat points. So one of their most interesting pieces are why they think millennials are sometimes perpetually unhappy. Or I should say more specifically, they call them Gen Y yuppies. They call them gypsies.
So it's kind of inspiring. They've made it big, but they've stayed true to their nerdiness.
They have, and you know, even though they only started in July, so less than 6 months, already have more than 250,000 subscribers, and really interesting their ability to use graphs and charts to bring things alive.
Finally, you have a surprising factoid in your fast-forward section this week. There are rumors that a Harley-Davidson dealership could be coming to Vietnam.
We all think of China as the booming economy in Asia. In the past, we thought certainly of Japan and even India. But increasingly, Vietnam is that place that's showing a lot of spark. They've been growing at 5 or 6%, now literally going back 20-plus years, third largest oil producer. And one of the ways you see some of that financial success starting to show up, believe it or not, are more and more Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And I know you own one, Arun.
Of course.
On the road of Ho Chi Minh City.
And they're not, you know, they're popular. They're not like this symbol of you know, imperialist capitalism.
Well, interestingly enough, no. It's funny. I've visited Vietnam a couple of times, and I'm not surprised to see this as kind of a next step. And while they can be quite expensive, in fact, they're heavily taxed in order to buy one there, you still are not only seeing more and more of them, but in fact, a Harley-Davidson dealership is expected to open towards the end of this year or early next year.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talk about at npr.org/new and next. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, always good to be with you. Have a terrific weekend.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. A little less than 2 weeks ago, the state of Florida executed convicted murderer William Happ using a combination of drugs never tried before.
An execution scheduled to take place in Florida on Tuesday is stoking controversy for using an untested lethal injection drug.
Florida is using an untested drug because of a nationwide shortage of approved lethal injection drugs. The death penalty may be settled law in America, but the way we implement it is very unsettled as states across the country sort out the proper way to execute inmates. That's our cover story today. The story begins on May 25th, 1986, and a note that our report includes details that some listeners will find disturbing. On that evening in May, a young travel agent named Angie Crowley was driving from Fort Lauderdale to Yankeetown, Florida. Late in the evening, the 21-year-old pulled up near a payphone to call her friend, who was going to guide her the last few miles of the trip. But Crowley never made it to the phone. At the rest stop, William Happ broke her car window, kidnapped and killed her. A fisherman eventually found her body in a nearby canal. In 1989, Happ was sentenced to death for Crowley's murder and rape. For decades, Happ appealed and lost. The sentence of death remained, but the method of execution changed. Since 1924, Florida had used the electric chair to execute prisoners. But in 2000, facing pressure from the Supreme Court, the state switched to lethal injection. More than a quarter century after the murder of Angie Crowley, Happ's execution date was set. On October 15, 2013, he would die from a lethal injection of a three-drug cocktail. But the state had a problem. Supplies of the first drug in that cocktail, an anesthetic, were running low. As the execution date approached, the state ran out of the drug altogether. So the Florida Department of Corrections decided to use a new anesthetic, a sedative called midazolam that had never been tested for execution. Nobody knew exactly how it would work. Brendan Farrington witnessed the execution of William Happ for the Associated Press. He described the scene in the viewing room.
The room has four rows of chairs, about 10 chairs in each row. The last row is slightly elevated, and that's where media witnesses are. It's a very solemn, serious, quiet atmosphere. There's no talking. They bring the witnesses in, and there's a screen across a long rectangular window. And when they're ready to begin, the screen slowly rises. the person conducting the execution will announce that the sentence is about to be carried out, tells this to the condemned and asks if he has any last words. In this case, William Happ gave a fairly lengthy final words. He admitted he committed the crime and expressed shame for it and said that, you know, he hopes that God forgives him and he realizes that the family probably could not.
At 6 p.m. sharp, the execution began. Since the drug midazolam was being used for the first time in an execution, Farrington was watching closely to see how it would work.
While it wasn't dramatically different than previous executions, it did seem like it took him longer to lose consciousness. Of the other three executions I've seen, the condemned, once the procedure begins, they'll go under fairly quickly, and once their eyes close, they usually stay closed. In Happ's case, his eyes were still opening 2, 3, 4 minutes into the process. Once they closed, about 10 minutes in, his head started moving kind of just around, and there was some motion.
There is no way to know if William Happ was in pain during his last moments. But some anesthesia experts have expressed concern that midazolam and other untested sedatives could fail to work properly during an execution. If that happened, condemned prisoners could die slowly or painfully, a violation of legal guidelines for executions. Megan McCracken studies lethal injection drugs for the Death Penalty Clinic at the UC Berkeley School of Law. We reached her on her cell phone.
If the first drug does not, in fact, deeply anesthetize the prisoner, then he or she could be conscious and aware of being both paralyzed and able to experience the pain and then the experience of cardiac arrest.
NPR's Kathy Lohr has been covering the shortage of lethal injection drugs for years. I asked her how we got to this point with an acute shortage of lethal injection drugs and states considering untested alternatives.
Well, it all started a few years ago when a drug company called Hospira stopped making one of the drugs that most states had used in their lethal injections, sodium thiopental. So the company was the only maker of the drug in the United States. It's an anesthetic, and it was used for years in lethal injections as part of this three-drug protocol. But by 2011, the company stopped manufacturing it. In part, it really wanted to distance itself from executions. And when that happened, there was a shortage, and which basically led states to search for the drug wherever they could find it. And so some were even trading it among each other if they had a larger supply and another state didn't have enough. But when that supply either expired or ran out, states had to come up with new protocols to conduct lethal injections. And basically what that's meant is finding new drugs.
So what have the states been doing to find new drugs?
Well, some states have been putting executions on hold, for example, California, North Carolina, and Arkansas. But other states have been announcing, the officials at the Department of Corrections have just announced that they're going to use these new drugs. So many are looking at pentobarbital. It's a sedative, and instead of doing three drugs, they'll just give a large dose of this single drug. Now, Missouri has an execution scheduled in November. But Missouri's an interesting case because the governor there recently canceled an execution because the state had said it was going to use another drug, propofol. That is a widely used anesthetic in hospitals for a lot of surgeries. So I spoke with Richard Dieter. He opposes the death penalty, and he's also the director of the Death Penalty Information Center. And he talks about what recently took place in Missouri.
Propofol, that's the most widely used anesthetic in the U.S. If it was restricted for distribution because of this rather small area of the death penalty, that would be a problem. So I think Missouri wisely got out of that whole crisis area and now finds a local pharmacy that will make a different drug and joins Texas and some other states like Ohio and Georgia in this process.
We talked to a spokesman for the company that supplies 95% of the propofol used in the U.S. Here's Matt Kuhn of the German company Fresenius Kabi.
When Missouri made its announcement last year that it was considering propofol as a single-agent protocol for its executions, we implemented distribution controls. We limited the number of distributors who could distribute the product in the U.S., and we reached agreement with those distributors that they would not sell the product to departments of corrections in the U.S.
Kuhn explained why the company had to take steps to prevent state departments of corrections from using propofol in executions.
The propofol from Fresenius Kabi is manufactured in Europe, and the European Union has a statute that does not allow the export of any product that might be used in capital punishment. And so the fact that we supply 90% of the U.S. market, if propofol was used in an execution, then the likelihood of sanctions or a ban exporting it from the European Union would become a reality. And in turn, that would lead to a shortage of the product that's used 50 million times a year in the U.S.
So, Kathy, just this week, Missouri announced that it would not use propofol. They're going to start using pentobarbital. But another new issue is that Missouri and a number of states now say that they're getting their drugs from compounding pharmacies. That bypasses the big European drug manufacturers altogether. But there are some concerns about that approach, too, right?
Yes, those who are challenging this idea say that the pharmacies may not be reliable. The issue is that these compounding pharmacies are not regulated by the FDA. So that's been called into question. And Texas, Ohio, and Missouri all have announced plans to use compounding pharmacies just this month. The drugs they're producing, including this pentobarbital, are not made specifically for executions, and no court has actually reviewed this process. So if the drugs cannot be validated as effective, this could be a violation of an inmate's Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment. So here again is Richard Dieter, and he explains what the problems could be if these drugs are not effective, if they're contaminated, or if they just don't work as intended.
It could be painful. It could be, partial unconsciousness and a person, slowly going through conscious knowledge of their dying and their pain, but not being able to shout out or move. There's a lot of things. I think we should be using the best practice, not what's available, and that's what we've come down to. What can the states get a hold of from the back room of local pharmacies rather than what's recommended by medical experts?
Kathy, I understand states are also refusing to release any details about these compounding pharmacies. They're keeping the details a secret?
That's right. In Missouri, the officials just announced that keeping the pharmacy details a secret is going to be written into the law. And Georgia recently passed a law that says the identity of people or companies that manufacture or supply these drugs used in executions is a classified and confidential state secret. Now, that's, caused some uproar here, and a Georgia inmate is challenging the law in court. His attorneys say they need this information about where the drug is coming from and how it's manufactured, even to know if they can mount a legal challenge.
So why is the state keeping this a secret?
Well, the state has argued there's a good reason to protect the identity of these pharmacies, because they say that if they reveal the information, the pharmacies may not want to sell drugs to the state, and that would prevent them from carrying out executions. So that issue is now making its way through the courts in Georgia, and the execution of an inmate, Warren Lee Hill, it's on hold. Also, more legal challenges are expected on this issue across the country.
NPR's Kathy Lohr joined us from Atlanta. Kathy, thank you.
My pleasure.
On November 12th, Florida will use midazolam for the second time. On the same day, Texas will carry out an execution with pentobarbital it will likely get from a compounding pharmacy. And across the nation, the legal challenges continue as states struggle with a shortage of the only drugs approved for execution. Artist Gris Grimley made his name creating beautiful and terrifying illustrations, including for many children's books. Flip through his wicked nursery rhymes or Sipping Spiders Through a Straw, and you'll see the creatures that populate nightmares. And so it is in his latest work, though this one is a graphic novel. It's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, brought to life in Grimley's rusty punk rock Victorian world. The story goes like this. Dr. Victor Frankenstein assembles a man from parts of corpses and brings him to life. But the creature is repulsive, and Frankenstein abandons him. The unwanted child spends the rest of the novel exacting monstrous revenge on his creator. We asked Gris Grimley into NPR West to talk about his creation, an illustrated version of Mary Shelley's novel. Gris Grimley, thanks for coming in.
Of course.
So first off, your Frankenstein, the visual depiction, I mean, he's been fearsome in the movies, but he's more disturbing in your rendering. I mean, he's difficult to look at in a way that there are bones and viscera that are visible, and he's more horrific, I think, in a way that mm-hmm. feels more genuine.
Yeah, that's funny, because it's definitely, I have like a fascination with the skeletal structure. I love the skeleton Halloween outfit. Like, you know, just people wearing skeleton shirts that look, you know, the rib cage is exposed. And so I try to incorporate that in a lot of my artwork.
And the world that the characters inhabit that you draw, it's sort of an ahistorical world. It feels mm-hmm. kind of Victorian, but sort of steampunkish. There are weird mechanical contraptions and automobiles mixed in. How did you come up with that conception?
Well, first of all, there's an artist, Bernie Wrightson, and he did a version of Frankenstein, which is, I mean, it's my favorite illustrated version. I think it's a lot of people's favorites. And
it's a fairly classic, sort of straight,
very traditional,
gothic.
Like gothic. And I see Bernie Wrightson's Frankenstein as a masterpiece, and I didn't want to go there. So that kind of set the ground rules. Like, I was going to make it my own world, my own time period, my, you know, something kind of surreal and have an element of rock and roll to it.
Mm-hmm. People just sort of have the broadest outlines of the story. I'm wondering what you're trying to draw out in your rendering that people may be missing.
Well, I mean, it's just so much more rich than the movie adaptation. And I think that, I mean, let's face it, maybe it wasn't this way for you, but the first time I tried to read Frankenstein, I didn't get through it. And I'm finding this is the same with a lot of people. Frankenstein is not the easiest read when you're young. Mm-hmm. So I had the films as that became my interpretation of the book until I could read the book. And I wanted to change that for the young generations to come, to give them a way to read the words and interpret the words and get all the way from page 1 to page 200 and say, I've read Frankenstein, and not have to rely on the movies.
And it's very faithful to the text. I mean, I think so faithful to the text, I don't think there's a word in there that's not from the novel, is there?
Not a word that's not from the novel,
yeah.
But it's abridged. We had to cut it back because every page is illustrated. In order to do that, we had to cut some of the dialogue out.
You know, I think that a lot of people that come to the book after the movie, which is probably most of us now, I mean, it was me since I grew up in the age of movies and everybody mm-hmm. did, is that the book feels so much more sympathetic to the monster.
Right.
And gets you inside his head. And that seemed something that you really took to.
You definitely get a sense of the monster's pain. And, you know, even though he's a monster, there's elements of it, you know, where he, you know, he goes and sees that girl next to the shore.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's throwing flowers in the water. And
right.
he wants to be a part of that. And he throws her in the water and she ends up dying. You know, you can tell he wants to play, but he ends up killing her.
And you see some of that childlike quality to him.
Yeah. You know, it is definitely a huge part of the book. And, you know, some people say that that has to do with Mary Shelley's upbringing and the pain that, you know, she felt ostracized. And so she put that into that character. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, drew me to the story in the beginning is the fact that I kind of felt ostracized growing up. You know, I grew up in the country on a farm, and I just didn't fit in growing up. And not only that, to go back and really pinpoint it, when I was 5 years old, I was burned, seriously. My back, you know, most 80% of my skin. So I grew up feeling kind of like a monster. I felt that I was that creature that wanted to fit in to society, but was consistently told that I couldn't. And I think that's one of the things that has always attracted me to the Frankenstein story.
Chris, this was great. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Artist Chris Grimley, his version of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is out now. The Oscars are 4 months away, but Hollywood insiders are already on the attack. Studios spend a ton of money on publicity campaigns to convince voters their contender is this year's Casablanca. But there are also whisper campaigns to take down the competition. Scott Feinberg recently wrote about it for The Hollywood Reporter. Scott, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So how does a whisper campaign work? Who whispers? Where do they whisper?
It's not always clear. You can't always trace them back to their source because part of the art of the whisper campaign is that it is hard to trace. They originate generally from people who want to see other movies do less well than they otherwise would for one reason or another.
So what would be an example of one from this year?
One that I would highlight this year is it has to do with Captain Phillips, a movie about the captain of the U.S. cargo ship that was hijacked in the Somali Straits a few years ago.
Right.
And played by Tom Hanks in the movie, he's portrayed as really a kind of a selfless hero.
Mm-hmm.
However, New York newspaper recently passed along comments from crew members on that ship without citing specific names, saying that this movie misrepresents what really happened, that in fact Captain Phillips was not so selfless and heroic, but put the ship in danger that led to the hijacking, and has since sort of glorified his role in what happened when it was hijacked.
These are some examples involving historical inaccuracies. What about other totally different genres of film? Like, how would you take down something that's a fantasy or science fiction or something else?
Well, I'll tell you what they're trying with Gravity, which is, it's obviously science fiction. And the one that happened with Gravity is not as malicious at all. I think what happened was Neil deGrasse Tyson, a very respected scientist, saw the movie and felt compelled to send out 20 tweets in the middle of the night, the same night he saw it, that were basically pointing out scientific things that he took issue with in the movie. And, you know, it kind of went viral, as things do with the internet. A few days later, he himself went back to Twitter and also posted something on Facebook saying, "Look, guys, I never expected this kind of attention. I overall liked the movie, and I could have and should have pointed out the hundreds of things that were accurately portrayed scientifically."
Is there any evidence that Whisper campaigns have ever had an impact on awards?
I would say that, you know, obviously we can't say definitively that it caused the movie not to win or the actor. It is actually very interesting when you look at almost every time it's happened, it's been to the movie that was clearly looking like it was going to win the Best Picture Oscar, mm-hmm. and it still ends up winning. So with The Hurt Locker, supposedly it was an inaccurate depiction of what it's like to be an explosives guy in the military, like the characters in the movie. With Slumdog Millionaire, supposedly the filmmakers who did quite well with the movie did not properly compensate the young Indian actors. And in each of those cases, the movie still ended up winning the Best Picture Oscar. And so I don't know that it will have a market impact. It's definitely noticed.
Scott, I'm just kind of curious. All the effort that's being put into Whisper campaigns, on top of the huge amounts that studios spend on traditional promotion to get notice for their films around award season, is it worth it? Is an Oscar worth that much?
Not everybody spends huge amounts of money, but at this point, many do, and it gets into the millions. Yes, being able to put Oscar nominee or Oscar winner on your newspaper ad will drive more people to the theater to see it if it's still in theaters, or if it's not, it will lead to greater sales of DVDs. Whether it's worth the amount of money that is spent is very much up for debate, because some years it just gets out of control. People become as they get closer to the finish line and they can sort of taste it, they pour more and more money into this. And, you know, sometimes I think it is a matter of ego for a studio chief. There's something cool about being the best or being called the best in front of all your peers, and the others have to sort of sit while you get your glory.
Scott Feinberg is the lead awards analyst at The Hollywood Reporter. Scott, thanks.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Alexander Ebert is the singer and songwriter behind rock band Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. Recently, and somewhat abruptly, Alexander Ebert became a film score composer. He wrote the music for All Is Lost, a movie directed by J.C. Chander that stars Robert Redford as a solitary man lost at sea. Between the opening and the credits, barely a word is spoken, leaving the music front and center. Alexander Ebert joins me in the studio. Alex, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, you know, for people who haven't seen the movie, Robert Redford is a sailor on a boat. It's damaged and he's trying to survive. That's the entire film. It's a pretty stark and open canvas to work with. What was it like composing music for something like that?
Man, it really felt like stepping into nothing and just sort of putting that first color on that gigantic canvas. I had had some great conversation with JC, the director, about, you know, what to do, but it was very sort of like esoteric talk. It was nothing specific. The only real specific thing I got was no piano. And so that sort of started my journey, discovering finally the alto flute as the mouthpiece for the main theme. For instance, the alto flute sounds like an approaching ship in some ways. When you just hear a single note, it sounds to me like a foghorn. And of course, it's also a very breathy instrument that reminds me of the wind and something calling to him. And in this case, sort of for that main theme, Excelsior, his surrender, his own surrender calling to him.
In the beginning, it's very subtle. The entrance of the music is imperceptible, really, the way it sort of comes up. And there are times when there's no music at all. It's just the natural sound. Did you work that out with the director, like where you would have music and not?
Yeah, in our first meeting, after reading the script, I told him that I thought that silence was the other sort of main character and that I really wanted to respect the silence. And by silence, of course, I mean the natural sounds and the sounds that Redford is hearing. And actually, originally, I even wanted to try and compose a single piece that would begin with a good minute, 2 minutes of silence between each note, so that the song was very particulated at the beginning and then would slowly, sort of the notes would get closer and closer together and you'd end up with a song. And, you know, it was one of those things where it's a natural instinct for any sort of serious director to be very reticent to include any music that's presenting itself too melodically. Because after all, what's music doing in my story anyway? You know, this is life, this is not a musical. I think that the one thing we agreed on is that there should be a lot of respect for the natural sounds and the silence that this character is experiencing. Otherwise, we're not gonna be thrown into the mind state and the reality of this movie.
Again, because there's no dialogue, your music is out there and exposed in a way that it's kind of unusual for a Hollywood film.
Yeah, it was sort of a scary experience watching it the other day. I went to the movie theater and watched it, and for me it was hard to tell exactly how upfront it was, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's a scene in one of my favorite pieces called Dance of Lilies, where it... the storm finally comes in a major way, and I was very keen on including a lot of melody somehow. And so that rub there, I think, created a nice dialogue, and it shows itself in that scene.
I'm speaking with Alexander Ebert. He wrote the score to the new Robert Redford film, All Is Lost. You've been involved in bands and played with musicians, but composing is a solitary activity. Did you kind of have a sense of isolation yourself? Were you able to evoke that more easily?
I had some different ideas of what to do, but I would just sort of think about myself in some ways being out at sea, and it was very easy to go totally hog wild and just fill it from beginning to end with music, because every inch of it is poetic.
It's interesting, though. I mean, there's atmospheric qualities in your music and your band, like in the Edward Sharpe stuff, but it's still quite a jump from songs to the abstraction and big canvas of a movie.
Yeah, it's a huge jump, certainly from the outside. The whole time I was super giddy because I knew I could do it, and I was very excited to do it. And to be able to write something that did not have a chorus and that would play for as long as it needed to and naturally disappear and come back whenever it needed to and then naturally disappear again, as opposed to sort of feel forced into a particular mode. For me, that was very natural, actually. It was super liberating.
There's one part in the film before the song at the end where there is sort of, it's kind of a choral sound. I feel like I'm hearing the human voice.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what that is. And
that was me.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Were you singing words?
Well, no, I wasn't. I was just going, you know, ooh, and just using my falsetto voice to to sing. And also earlier in Dance of Lilies and during the storm, I actually sing with a full chest voice, as they say, and sort of belt out some ahs over the whole thing. Early on, I know JC said he wanted to hear my voice. I wasn't so sure about that, but I was able to find some places where it made sense.
And why in those couple of places? What were you trying to evoke?
In that last scene, it just wanted that, finally. There was nothing else there. There was no other sort of, like, no other humanity there except for the immense humanity, the singular humanity that was sort of surviving the whole time. And
it's a powerful moment in the film.
It is, yeah. It's... I guess a welcoming and an ascension.
Composer Alexander Ebert, he wrote the score to the new film All Is Lost. Alex, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
For the week ending October 27th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening. Amen. I'll never say goodbye. I'll never tell you lies. I'll never.